ready. It's time to forge the narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Forge the Narrative Age of Sigmar podcast. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined today by Justin Troop and Kelly Fryborg.
We are really forging a narrative.
Are we? Hey, guys.
Chris Morgan and Miles Hamrick.
Just still high on Aether Gold.
What's going on?
Hey, thanks for joining us again. This is episode 2 of this. We had a little bit of delay. Ricky cannot be here. He's actually on assignment for his military gig, and that's kind of what we were kind of waiting on, but then it turned into a bigger deal. So anyway, we're rolling with this crew, and I hope you guys are okay with it.
Too bad.
Well, hopefully tune in. Miles, let's talk about a little bit of hobby segment. Miles, you've been working on some orcs. Sorry, Iron Jaws.
Yeah, Iron Jaws. Aurochs. Yeah, absolutely. Trying to figure out some skin tones and paints, trying to be a little different. Don't want to have the green and yellow color scheme that everybody else is going with that GW has on the books. I like to be a little different.
I saw your progress today. It's on Twitter. Please check it out. It looks very nice. Justin, you might actually be our tournament ringer here on the show for Sigmar.
Yeah, probably got the most games in now at this point. What's happening lately is at my local GW store, Sigmar is that's it, right? That's all we're doing. And then there's a couple local game stores that do, quick three rounders. Some of them a little bit more low point skill. So I've been getting a lot of practice at 1500, which I don't quite like, but I've got a good feel for the game now, and I'm enjoying that.
Does that count even though you're playing Stormcast?
Don't judge me, all right? Like, I'm cheap.
Low-hanging fruit.
Kelly, you got a bunch of armies going on right now, too. I mean, I think I've seen your Death and your Sylvaneth.
Yep, I have a full Death army and a full Sylvaneth army painted. Next up on the board is a Scene Charm that's going to be Dark Crystal themed. That's what I'm working on now.
That's sexy.
Dark Crystal?
That's sexy.
I'm pretty excited about it.
Exactly. Oh, man. I was
exactly.
Still a little bit of Chris's thunder. Chris on our 40K show makes a ton of puns. I don't want to call them bad puns because I think like most puns are inherently bad.
No, they're bad. they're terrible.
So I had to sneak that one in real quick. It might have been before it started. I can't wait to see, because some of the work that you, every bit that I've seen, you have a lot of converted miniatures that you post up on Twitter.
I do. I have a conversion problem, I think. Like, I just started painting minis, and then all of a sudden, everything I do, it's like, this is cool, but I'd like to change this about it, and I'd like to change that about it. A lot of them are models that are multiple models that I have in the army, and I don't want them, because Age of Sigmar is generally not a lot of machines, I don't like when something that's organic looks identical to something else that's organic, so I do a lot of conversions because of that.
That's a really good mindset. Have you put together a bunch of dryads? Because I put together 20 of those this weekend, and they are a pain, and they're all unique.
I have 60.
Man,
I have 60 done.
This is it's. I know they look very much in the vein of the Sylvaneth that are out right now. People need to remember that they're an older kit. This one, they've been out for 10 years or more. So it's a different mindset how the models are put together now all together. And they're a little bit fiddly.
They have really intense mold lines. Yeah, so you have to, once you learn how to kind of one scrape a really thick mold line, you're good. It's more of a carving than a scraping. that will save you a ton of time. It's a lot of models, and it's a lot of old models. Before I was working on this stuff, I was working on a Bretonian's army, so that's worse even.
Wait, glutton for punishment, aren't you?
I really am. I am. I need to just get on board with all the new stuff, because it's a breeze to put together compared to the older models.
And modular,
on board, because there's transports in Sigmar now.
Oh, man, you just waited for that. You just came out of nowhere.
Kelly, you mentioned mold lines. So a lot of the newer kits, we don't have mold lines anymore, but by God, am I filling gaps. Has anybody else been noticing that?
Especially on mounted miniatures. So if something's riding on an animal or Dragoth or Gore Grunners, there's gaps.
I haven't had that experience, man. This Sylvaneth stuff has gone together like a dream.
Well, it's trees and stuff. You can have cracked wood.
But I don't. That's what I'm saying. It's pretty spot on.
He's been watering them regularly, so I'm sure that's made a big difference.
You got the green thumb, do you?
I'd like to think so.
I just did like a Lord Aquilor, and that went together. I didn't have to do anything to it, actually. There were still mold lines, because, even if there's a tiny little something on a muscle, you want to carve that off, but there's no green stuffing on that. But I have had a gap fill quite a few of the newer things that I've had, but when you compare that to like old vampire counts like Black Knights, it's totally fine. I can definitely do it.
Yeah, I hear those units are just kind of a double whammy because you've got that problem and then the fact that I guess they're not too hot in the rules right now. So anyone who really, like, they must be a really dedicated death player if they're going to go through all that trouble.
Yeah.
You gotta have them, man. Sigmar, there's this thing, and it's called melee, and it happens on turn one 95% of the time. So you need fast units to just throw at people sometimes. So even if you have crappy cavalry, sometimes you're just forced to take it.
The nice thing with death is a lot of it flies. So especially the newer stuff that they come out with, like Nagash Pass, quite a bit of it flies. So that's a huge plus for that army. And then also, obviously, the Bravery 10 is massive.
Yeah, I'm no sure brain checks.
It gets a lot easier to get through escape velocity when you pretty much get rid of all the muscle and stuff on things.
Can right? Skeletal horses still pass through scenery? And that's how long it's been since I've really played with death.
Oh, you're speaking of the hex rates.
Oh, it's now a specific thing because it used to be like the undead horses weren't slowed by terrain. They were spectral and could go right through things.
Oh, they still have some of that on there. I know the kit that makes both the Black Knights and the hex wraiths. I believe the hex wraith old rule was that they could pass through terrain, pass through enemy models and things of that nature without having to take any sort of check, which I think that's crossover, but you really don't see them on the board that much. Most death players I played has been like the huge ghoul packs.
Gotcha. Yeah. Chris, I don't want to skip you. You're new to the Sigmar, Age of Sigmar. I know you've had some dwarves in the past and have played dwarves, but I think you're trying to jump in with both feet with this Caradon Overlords.
That's right. Yeah, I actually just picked up my Ironclad yesterday, and I have just been going gaga over this model so far. I am just in love with all of the little character. Indeed, I mean, you got guys that are hanging off the side. You've got the Navigator. He's got this. It almost kind of reminds me of, I don't know if any of you guys play the Elder Scrolls or anything like that, but the Dwemer have all of these like orb sort of scientific instruments around. A lot of it kind of feels like that, which is really cool for me. A lot of my fantasy experience is more classic fantasy, like Lord of the Rings, things like that. And old Warhammer felt just a lot like a reskin of Lord of the Rings to me. So when they branched out with Sigmar, it was really kind of it was what drew me into it, is just how different it felt from your classic fantasy setting, where it's like, I have elves in the woods and I have dwarves underground and I have orcs that are green and they're warlike and blah, blah, blah. So it still has all of those little points, but they're all skewed in a different direction and have a lot more character. And I just instantly fell in love with the Overlord's aesthetic.
They have taken the time to make this stuff specific to Games Workshop, which, of course, we can take a look at the business side of why that's a good idea. But on the fun side, it gives us some characterful and unique things.
Yeah. Doors from the sky. I mean, come on. Like, yeah. Goodbye, mountain.
Yeah. But I mean, there's still dwarves, right? It's like, oh, we found this thing in the sky and it's really cool and valuable and it lets us do it. Let's just call it sky gold because we're still dwarves and we still want gold. So anything valuable is still gold and we're still going to mine it. That's going to be our lives, but we're flying now. So, I mean, it still makes sense to me.
I'm on board. I mean, literally and figuratively, I love it. I think it's awesome.
Yep. I'm all over it.
Let's talk about the specifics of Caradon Overlord since they're the newest thing in a little bit. We'll probably save that for the second segment. But this has been a really cool journey. Like, I'm painting these Sylvaneth. I finally have 2,000 points. I'm 20 dryads away from the 2,000 points. Solid Sylvaneth painted. I got a little bit of a setback day this weekend because of the bad weather. So I didn't prime when I wanted to. But now I'm ready. I should be able to get my 2,000 points completed by the end of this week.
So you're saying that if you had primed in the bad weather, they would have been wet ads instead of dry ads?
They would have been really crappy looking. That's what they would have been.
Okay.
So I'm really, really excited about that. I'm doing, again, trying to challenge myself a little bit on the paint side, going outside of my comfort zone, watching tutorials, getting the tips where I can, and applying it and really making it cool. And then I found these stick-on tough flowers for the bases. I'm trying to put together kind of an army that looks good from about 3-4 feet away.
You know, there's this podcast I know of. They got this cool segment. It's called Finishing Moves. They do it at the end of every episode. You should check it out.
I will. I've said this on our other show, though. I was trying to skip a step. I'm sitting there at my hobby desk and I'm trying to skip a step. And I'm like, no, I can't. I know it only takes 5 minutes. Let's do it.
Yep. Because we believe in you, Paul Murphy. You can do the thing.
Well, we talk about
that's how you get it right.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I said, hopefully we can work something like this in, especially because Age of Sigmar models have a lot more detail on them than the average 40K model.
You've gone nuts with these sculpts. Like, absolutely bonkers.
They're great models.
I will say the only thing I do have against them is a lot of time in the feet molded in already is like terrain features. So I find myself having to like carefully clip those out and stuff.
I do that quite a bit too. They are, especially like your unit heads or kind of feature models in an army usually are attached to some kind of decorative base, which is great for people who don't want to do anything to the base. It really, I mean, it makes sense because it makes the model stand out from the rest of the army and it does look cool on the base without having to do anything. But for people who, you know, put a full army idea together to kind of be pigeonholed into that one base is not ideal. So I find myself cutting that stuff off all the time too.
Yeah, I just recently I've been trying to figure out how I'm going to do my Star Drake, and you know, he's like climbing over like this castle that's been crumbled up and stuff. So, you know, I'm basically, like you said, the guy I'm forced to keep that because there's no way I'm going to be able to carve all that out and do everything that I got to do to make it look proper again. So now I'm actually considering rebasing my whole army and putting kind of a crumbled castle theme into it just so it matches the centerpiece of my army, which is the Star Drake.
Well, GW makes those great bases that you could pick up that go along with that Star Drake.
Shameless plug.
With those, like, I guess, molded stuff on the feet, because the Kurnoth Hunters have those, where they've got these, like, little platforms or pads they're standing on. I'm using the Lustrian Undergrowth as the material for most of my basing, and I'm dry brushing over that with some, like, a khaki color. It works. I don't know why it works. I'm sure there's some color theories to tell me why that looks all right together. But what I've found is that if you can use that almost in layers. You can use the texture paint, you know, put one coat down around where the platform is and then wait till that dries completely and then come back over it. And you get like a smooth transition between the base and the foot, and it kind of hides that low profile feature. Now, obviously, this is not for like ruins and some of the stuff that's on some of the more extreme ones, but for that little pad at some of the end of the feet, I found that a couple of coats, the texture paste works pretty well.
Yeah, you get some pretty neat, I don't want to say texture, but a unique design to it and look to it as well when you start layering it up. I got a couple that I've done two or three coats, and it does. It's got this different feel to it than just what a normal one coat would do. You know, you see like a lot of people, they do it and it almost looks like just there's like subtle waves in it, and then they do the dry brushings. But the top coat and the finish of how it's drying up top just seems different. It could just be how I applied it to, and I just did that on my own and not knowingly, but it seemed cooler. I'll take some pictures and put them on that Twitter thing that everybody talks about.
There's some things you can do with that stuff, and it's there and easy to use. And I don't think people that haven't used them yet understand just kind of how easy that stuff is and how it can make a big impact on your figures.
I've been actually agonizing how I'm going to base my character and overlords just because the ship plating, the hulls, like it isn't a wood panel or it isn't lined with wood when they're walking on the deck. It is all metal. And so I saw that GW came out with some Sector Mechanicus bases, and I want to look at those and see if there are like too many Imperial symbols or anything on there, because the idea that these guys come from floating sky cities that are all made of this aether gold metal that's been distilled and mined and whatever to a solid kind of makes me think like, well, these guys, they don't really live on the ground anywhere. So having a ground type base, it just doesn't feel right for me. But if I'm going to do something industrial, I want it to look right.
Let's piggyback on
that.
I feel
like you could do something totally crazy too with like how people do for 40K if tanks and such are on fire with cotton balls and like LEDs in them.
That is what I was going to say.
Storm clouds.
I've seen a couple guys use the spray foam that you get at Home Depot that expands when you spray it, and they've been making little puffs of clouds to either come out the smokestacks or be the base for the guys with the like hot air balloons
so for the savage. Backpack. Oh man, that's awesome.
I mean, the guys were doing it, and I've caught them on Twitter, and they look amazing.
I'm gonna need to look at that. Like, tag me in some pics if you guys have, or if you have seen anything. You guys can go, you know, at sanguine_Morgan is my Twitter page, and I pretty much it's exclusively for hobbies. So if there's something cool, tag me in it so I can take a look at it, because I'm really on the fence about what I want to do, but there's so many cool ideas here.
If you're not used to working, if you've never worked with the great stuff or the spray insulation expanding foam, it is a nightmare. Do it outside and do it with gloves and don't have it anywhere near any of your painted figures until you're sure you know what you're doing. It sticks to everything and will never get on your shoe. That's now your shoe. That is how it works.
All of a sudden, you're walking on cloud nine.
It's great. Oh, there you go. It does. It is. You can even carve it. Like, after you've got it and after it dries, you can carve it like you would wood almost. I mean, it is an underused hobby tool, but that stuff is serious.
It's really good for like Nurgle theme stuff or Tyranid theme stuff. You can do like veins and big bulbous pustules and kind of organic-y looking things like that. It's real fun.
On one of my old Nurgle bases, display bases, I do have it spraying out of a sewer pipe as foam coming out, like a foamy frothing plague soup or something. I don't know, whatever. I'm telling you, it is real. Do not want to mess around. You want to get comfortable with that before you put it near anything that you don't want covered in it.
Yes,
that's pretty much a good advice. With everything,
though. Please do a test piece.
Yeah, right. I'm saying go outside, wear gloves, be in like a full hazmat suit. I mean, this stuff can get serious. But it has lots of uses. So, but it's cheap too. You'll get a can for $6 or whatever, and it will last probably your whole hobby project.
Mm, interesting.
But use it in one go. You probably want to get one can to practice with and one can to do it, because it's not something you can like cap effectively and come back to. At least that's not been my experience.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
That sounds pretty neat, though. So anyway, so we got varying degrees of hobby experience. I should say hobby Sigmar experience on the show. So I'm hoping as we start to talk about more of this and do more of these that, you know, we all, the same way we've done with 40K, is kind of get better along the way and learn things and digest stuff and how it fits in with the meta right now. Like, what does, now you guys that have played in tournaments, what do you see a lot of? I mean, I know Zinch is popular. I know Skyfires are on fire, literally, right now. What else do you see out there?
Cool. Beyond Zinch. Zinch. Now, Sylvaneth is actually really big. That's probably, I would say, the second most common army that I face. Miles, can you know, how are you seeing that?
I know, you know, since we live very close together, we definitely see similar lists. There are, you know, tons like tournament players are playing the Disciples of Zinch book. There are a couple guys picking up the Blades of Khorne book, Bloodletter Bombs, which are crazy. You know, they do mortal wounds on 6-ups, but then you're buffing them, so then you can get to the point to where you're doing mortal wounds on 3s. I mean, it's ridiculous. The Cunning Ruck is still good. Savage Orcs with a couple of the generic monsters that can run around. I believe, you know, all three of those lists did exceptionally well at the largest Age of Sigmar tournament over in the UK this past month, which was the South Coast GT.
Yep.
And they, I mean, Age of Sigmar is like, you get the models, you play, like, you can play at a decent level with just purchasing the models and reading your book.
Oh, wow. Yeah, for sure. Every faction has the ability to compete with every faction. There are just a couple standouts, like the Zinch stuff, it's just a little bit overpowered. But, you know, the General's Handbook, the way that it's being done now is that living rule set kind of deal. They're going to fix a lot of these things come the new General's Handbook too, where point scales might be fixed or profiles might get adjusted slightly to bring them a little bit more in line. Because, yeah, the Skyfires are just ridiculous right now. It's really hard to deal with those. And, you know, like the Bloodbound list that the Khorne book just dropped, you know, if you can't just dish out the pain to them right away, you're screwing yourself over and you're going to have an uphill battle for the rest of the game. So, you know, everything can and will be able to beat everything. It's just, you know, what is overpowered right now is the efficient stuff, the same stuff like we see in 40K. And that's going to be the stuff that you see in the tournament scenes that are just being used a little bit more.
Kelly, you see anything different out there on your side of the country?
No, it's pretty much the same story. Everyone got pretty heavily into Stormcast when they came out, so you still see quite a bit of those. Inevitably, basically every new army book that comes out, that's kind of what you see most of, kind of following that, because everyone really gets into it. But the thing I really like about the Age of Sigmar stuff, and that I've always liked kind of since they switched over to it, is you have so many people who played fantasy for a long time that now have the chance to really play whatever army they want. So they're kind of digging out their old stuff and maybe stuff that they had that didn't make any sense for fantasy, that didn't go with whatever other army, that they can slap together now and run. So you see a lot of crazy stuff at tournaments too, which I really like.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, I thought all those people like set their armies on fire or something.
They're coming back.
Yeah, good friend of the show, Reese, he just placed like 6th place or 7th place using Bretonians in the Free Peoples. So, I mean, and that's considered a very underpowered book because there's just not a lot of options. But, he found a combo in it and he's brutalizing people with it. So, that just goes back to what I was saying. It doesn't matter what you pick what you want and what you think looks good. And there's a way to use it. There's tons of battalion formation things you can do and all these different war host things that you can do. It constantly builds on each other, and you're never going to find a case, unless somebody just rolls massive amounts of sixes on you. But you're not going to ever feel like you're in this complete uphill battle. You have more than a swinger's chance going into any matchup.
That's really encouraging. Guys, let's take a quick break. We're going to do a segment with Benson Green from Mindworm Games, we're doing a segment about indie game design. So, and it keys into a lot of the things we've talked about in pre-segments we've had on previous shows. And if you guys hold tight, that's about a 10-15 minute segment, and then we'll come back and talk about some Caradon Overlord.
Sounds good.
All right.
Sounds like plan.
Forged Narrative is brought to you by Dicehead.com. www.dicehead.com. Games, hobby supplies, and comics, they have it all.
Hey everybody, thanks for listening. I'm still Paul. This is a special segment in the middle of the show. I've got Benson Green from Mindworm Games.
Howdy, nice to be back again.
Benson, thanks for joining me, man.
Yeah, it's fun every time.
You're a manufacturer of miniatures for people that may not be aware of what you do and what Mindworm Games is yet, but you produce the game Exiles, which is a Weird West type strategy, half role-playing game, half miniature-based game.
We call it a miniatures action role-playing game. It's like the best of a role-playing game in an RPG. So you get to play like a skirmish war game, and it has really tight rules for skirmish war gameplay if that's your bag. And then it gets you all the fun of character development and story in an RPG with like none of the work of having to actually run a role-playing game.
And you just put out an expansion for that product too, right?
Yes, it's called our Bell Knops campaign. It's an expansion campaign for our Outlaws faction. We have a 9 scenario story arc with an outlaw called Troy Hatcher and his Scarbelly gang. And we put out a mini campaign that's 3 scenarios that features a new outlaw boss named Bell Knops. And so you can use all the different minions and whatnot that comes in the Troy Hatcher set with this new boss and a whole bunch of new stories and a whole bunch of new fluff and new rules and new cards and all that business.
And thanks for coming on, because this is not why we have you on. What we've been doing is segments on like how to get into the business, how to survive in this competitive business, and how to distinguish yourself between other things as a producer of games, as a manufacturer.
Yeah.
And so, but I do want to talk about it because it's really cool. You sell a product that comes, it's very themed. I mean, you really care about the total experience of the gamer itself. So they get a really cool individualized box with a couple of miniatures and a bunch of storyline and background and stuff for including those in the game.
Yeah, you get all the materials, all the stuff you need to play. It's the product that we sell is sort of a weird format in terms of tabletop skirmish play. I guess a similar type of format might be the way Fantasy Flight Games does their Star Wars Imperial Assault stuff, where you get like a couple of miniatures, but then you get a story and you get some materials that you need to play the story, like tokens and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, we make everything by hand in house. And the feel you're talking about is the kind of handmade feel that we put into it. But, apart from the way we do Exiles, we also make miniatures. And so that's another area that we're breaking into. And right now, I've just been working all day in my shop on some contract casting for a company called Gangfight Games.
I want to talk about that, because what we've discussed is the product of building the idea of building a pipeline, getting art, making your miniatures. And you've actually gone even a step further and started doing the manufacturing.
Yes.
For your company yourself and not outsource that to anything. And now I think you found that because the way your game is designed and the way it fits is there are I guess, a smaller number of miniatures per product, I guess. I think you described it to me as you're not making a squad of 10 or 20 for us. You're having some neat characters on a smaller scale. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, exactly. So my product format for Exiles involves a lot, a smaller number of miniatures than you might have for a skirmish war game. So every person who plays like a character, right? So it's like a role-playing game in that I'm controlling one dude. So a lot of people who get into the game, they don't bother with buying the story. Somebody else buys the Troy Hatcher set, and that might come with, I think that comes with 8 miniatures. And then, but they buy their one guy, and right. So we don't sell a lot of high volume of miniatures. And so, like, I can go in the back, like the Bell Knobs thing. It comes with one miniature, Bell Knobs. My mold has 10 cavities. So I spin that once, I've got 10 units. So it takes me literally 5 minutes to make 10 Bell Knobs miniatures. So without spending a lot of time working the machine, I can do all the units I need for Exiles at the volumes we're currently selling. And so I've got machinery, and so it's always good to put your machinery to use. And so we took on a contract job with Gang Fight Games. But I think what's very interesting for your program, that what we're talking about now, is how similar and different Gang Fight Games is to Mindworm Games. So like Blackwater Gulch is the game that they're working on. They just did a Kickstarter for the second edition. And Tim, the guy who runs Gang Fight Games, the same thing as me. He has basically a one-man shop, and he runs the whole thing himself. And he also has a Wild West game. So, you know, Blackwater Gulch is a Weird West skirmish war game. So we have very similar products and very similar ways of running our businesses. The difference between Tim and I, though, is that my goal in Mindworm Games is to do as much as we can in-house with my own hands. I want to make it. I want to make everything I can. And over the years, as we grow, I'm going to be bringing more and more production in-house. We'll start doing resin casting. Hopefully, we'll start doing laser cutting. And hopefully, we might even start doing our own printed materials. But Tim, on the other hand, he wants to do none of that, right? He wants to have like an idea and a computer and farm everything out. And like in a perfect world for Tim, if he never had to touch one of his products, he would be happy as a clam.
I won't necessarily put that on him. I don't know, unless you got
no
that
no no out. No, he's happy about that. I think he's happy with that. So like his he's running the kind of business that it's possible to run these days, where anybody with an idea and a computer and a little bit of money and some know-how, you can make a game, and you might not even ever have to touch your product. And so it's a little bit different working with like a complicated network of contractors and vendors for all of your services versus doing everything in-house. And that's, you know, so Tim has the pitfalls that he has with that, and I have pitfalls with the way I do my business.
Well every business has challenges. So yes. I mean, this is just a different set. And I think that the takeaway here is that the way you built up your infrastructure allowed you to have, I guess, time on the machine, open time on the machines.
Yes.
So what better way? And also, I mean, I want to also kind of point out that you're being a good community member, I think, when you do this too, when you even offer this.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that in this community that do contract casting. So just to name a few, like Valiant is a big one that a lot of people use for resin casting and spin casting. There's Trenchworks. They do really good 3D printing and casting. They cast for Victoria Miniatures. I think some of your listeners will be familiar with them. There's also Zombie Smith. They do some fantastic casting. F and Cool Miniatures, Iron Wind. There's Fortress Figures is really, really, really good. And a lot of these guys have been doing this for a very, very long time. I'm very new to it.
And we're not name dropping either. This is informational. The reason we're discussing this is because this is a way, if you want to do things either the way you're doing or the way that you said Tim is doing, there are ways to get your game out there.
Yeah, and either way, even if you're going to buy a spincaster and do it, or if you're going to contract everything out, you need to know people like this. You need to know people in the community who do these things already, because you might need their advice. Like today, the guy from Fortress, I did a live video where I was cutting a mold, and I was diagnosing a problem I had with one of my molds, and he commented later on the video and said he thought I misdiagnosed the problem, and he thought it was a pressure thing. He said it was trapped air, right? But having these relationships, both on the production end and on the contracting end, is fantastic. So you might not know a company like F and Cool Miniatures, right? Like some people might not know that company exists when they're trying to find somebody to do their contract casting. And so it's good to know who's out there, because there's not a lot of resources around right now to just go and like find a list of all the different independent manufacturers.
But how did someone go about reaching out to you for this type of stuff?
Oh, you can just, you send me an email, Benson@mindroomgames.com, or contact us through the website. And that's how I think a lot of these small contract casting companies do their business. Like you just, you know, they have a website and you go out and contact them. It's all word of mouth and referrals mostly.
Good to know.
Yeah, but there's a lot of, like, Trenchworks. I met these guys at Adepticon. I hadn't heard of them before they were doing the 3D printing for Gang Fight Games. So one of the things that I got out of my relationship with Gang Fight Games is a great relationship, burgeoning relationship with these fantastic guys at Trenchworks. And now I know another available vendor who does 3D printing, and I will probably need their services somewhere down the road.
There you go. So don't work in a vacuum, I guess, to anybody who would be going on this.
Absolutely not. No, it's great to make friends. But one of the things I love about working in this industry is that, like, unlike my day job, this industry has so many great people who are not only really nice people individually, but they're willing to help out and they're willing to communicate and talk. And it's a really fantastic community. So the deeper I get into it on the production end, the more I'm enjoying the experience of being active in this community.
Where can people find your website?
Yeah, it's www.mindwormgames.com. It's pretty easy. And then you can find us on Facebook, too.
Yeah, but so tell them the Facebook, because you do, I guess, sit-in chats, and you actually turn the camera on while you're working and show off some of this stuff.
Yeah, and that's what I was doing today. My goal at Mindworm Games is to, and I think a lot of people in the industry are starting to do that now. So like Fortress Figures, for example, he posts a lot of work in progress photographs of, you know, things he's doing. But what I do most often is I just turn the camera on while I'm working. So today I did a 2-hour session where I was cutting a couple of molds. And I just, you know, I put my iPad up so I can see people's comments. And it's like any live stream, you know, I'm just doing my work. And if people have questions, they can ask. And I chat with people because I want people to see how it works. Because, you know, my goal at Mindworm Games is to help build a community of empowered gamers. So I want people to know what's going on, either because they're just curious about how their stuff gets made. I think that helps out the community at large. If people understand what work goes into the little metal dude they're buying. I also think it's fantastic for people who want to do their own manufacturing. So there's not a lot of formalized resources to learn how to spin cast, for example, or to do resin casting. Not that I do that, but so if you want to actually learn how to do it, I think that's a great resource. And I want to help people learn, you know, from my mistakes and from my successes as well. And then also, if you're trying to contract out these things, like I was saying before, one of the most important things when you're contracting with someone for services is knowing how that process works. So when you go to find somebody to spin cast your Kickstarter miniatures, it's a really good idea to know what a mold looks like, what materials molds are typically made out of, how venting works, you know, how long it takes to manufacture that. So all these things help you have a better sense of what the process is and how it works. For me, for example, one of the most terrifying things that's like slowing me down right now and getting new products out is that I've got a lot of bees putty miniatures, which is a polymer clay that are finished. But my understanding of how you treat a bees putty sculpt, because the material is a little bit fragile. So how you treat that in the process of doing an RTD silicone mold, I don't have a good idea about exactly all the ins and outs of that process. And so it can be a little stressful to not know those things, right? Like, you know, it makes it harder to make decisions about, you know, what vendors to use. And generally it at the very least, it involves a little bit of peace of mind. Like, okay, I know when I give this miniature to this guy, I know he's going to handle it this way. He's going to do this to it. Right. These are the risks involved in these kinds of processes. These are the risks that the miniature might break. You know, is it a low risk? Is it a high risk, et cetera? So I'm always happy to let people into, like, let's say, behind the scenes at Mindworm Games so that they can see exactly what we're doing and how we do it.
And you're doing it. You're not just some guy answering questions on a message forum or a Facebook group. You are actually doing this and people can see it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Knocking the camera over and everything. Burning myself.
Hey, it's fine. It's okay. I mean, not the burning yourself. I hope you're all right. But I mean, the realness, the organic quality of it, I think is just fine.
Yeah, I don't do any produced videos. That's one of the things that, like, I had to put on the back burner when I was doing my work. Like, you only have so many hours in the day because I have a day job. And even if you're doing your business 100% of the time, like even if you're doing miniatures and making your games 100% of the time, there's still only so many hours in the day. And one of the things I had to put on the back burner was doing more processed YouTube videos. So eventually we're going to do more text-based forum posts about with tutorials, because people like to digest this information in different ways. But that takes time. You have to stop and photograph, and then you got to edit the photographs, then you got to write the text, then you got to arrange everything. And then process videos as well for YouTube. Eventually, we'll start doing that. I'm going to, start getting a second camera on me that's going to be just for recording and editing, so we can put up more polished YouTube videos. But for right now, a lot of what we do is just Facebook Live, right?
So you mentioned, if I could just take us a little bit back a second, is that you mentioned the hours in the day, and that's exactly right, man. I mean, I tell you, we all have things that keep us occupied during the day, but it's how we can spend that time. If we can take information gathered from someone else, even if it's just, I don't want to say anecdotal, but specific to their situation, and save us a few minutes on our side of it, take it with us, do something with it that applies to us, then we're better off. And so I think that's kind of one of the purposes of this talk, and even to what you're doing and how you're doing it on your media stuff on your Facebook Live.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, knowing what's going on is always more helpful. It's always like, one of the frustrating things with spin casting, for example, just to, I know we're short on time here, but one of the frustrating things about spin casting is that a lot of people learned how to do spin casting almost with an apprenticeship sort of situation. So they trained with somebody. And so a lot of different people have slightly different setup, like different spin casters or different conditions in their workshop, or they use different things to form their molds, right? And all those things have little, effects, right? So when you talk to one person about, like, how do I do this? I have this problem. What is a solution? A lot of times there's not necessarily a consistent answer that's the same all the time, right? Because sometimes we call it voodoo, right? Yep. John Popson likes to call it voodoo, right? So everybody's, their own particular setups involve a little bit of voodoo. And so the more information I think anybody can get from more people in this space, the better, because the most helpful thing for me is to talk to like 7 different guys, right, who are doing their spin casting and find out, what they're doing, and look at what's consistent between what they're doing. Look what, what's different. Find out more about their particular setups and what's going involved in it. And like I said, I think it's fantastic for the industry as a whole to let people get behind the curtain and see what's going on. And I think, I think it just helps to build, a community around this little weird hobby that we have. Because every single one of these miniatures is made with love. Every single one of them. Nobody is doing this because it makes a boatload of money.
Man, well, thanks a lot for taking the time with me today. And I look forward to talking again very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. Anytime, man.
Have a good night.
You too.
FDN is also on Facebook. Please like us at www.facebook.com/ForgeTheNarrative.
Hey, everybody, we are back. I'm still Paul. I got Justin and Kelly.
What up?
Hello.
Miles and Chris.
At Miles the Hammer on Twitter. Shameless plug.
Andrin's primed.
Guys, thanks for sticking in for that segment. And now, as promised, we'll talk about some of the Caradhran overlords. Now, this book is getting like some interesting reception out there in the competitive side. But I think for the uniqueness of the figures and some of the way that kind of pushed the envelope with the Sigmar rules, this is an amazing book.
I think that it's got an incredible amount of character. And I think that it operates a lot differently than any of the other Sigmar stuff that I'm familiar with. And granted, I, being an experienced tabletop gamer, you get a feel for things pretty quickly. It's like, oh, that looks good. Oh, that seems less good. Looking at how these guys operate, it is a lot more akin to, I think of hit and run tactics and things like that. These guys just don't hold up as well as the heavy hitters that I've seen. And kind of like what I was saying a little bit earlier in the last segment is these guys feel like you just want to soften the enemy up before you engage him directly.
My philosophy with this book is it's very Dark Eldar like. I mentioned that earlier as well. You're skirting a lot. You're plucking away at people. You have pretty good shooting. It's not the best shooting in Age of Sigmar by any means, but there's some pretty good stuff in there, and some of the combos that they get to create are really good. But what I think sets this book apart from everything else is the dynamics of movement. And I'm just like, beyond the fact that they have transports, there's so much more dynamics to movement with this book and some of the units and some of the abilities that they get that I think it sets them apart from everybody else and makes them feel different in that aspect. And, you know, as Paul's been quoted 1,500 times as saying, you win a lot of these games in the movement phase. And that is very true in Age of Sigmar, because a half an inch in Age of Sigmar really matters.
Let's talk about that transports thing, because this is, as I understand it, brand new. Like, we don't have anything of the like going on in Sigmar right now.
These guys are the only ones with transports.
So can you guys that have played with it or at least familiar with it describe how that transport works?
The difference being, I mean, when you're trying to get in a transport, every model has to get within a certain distance. I believe it's 3 inches from the model you're trying to embark on. When you disembark, when you do all of that, is in the hero phase. So in the hero phase, you're going to go ahead and decide, all right, I'm going to get these guys out now, or I'm going to keep them inside and take them somewhere else. Because when they're inside, they can't do nothing. You know, they can't do anything.
Arcanaut Ironclad is what this is. This thing has an 8-inch move, which we will talk about, because as I understand it, there's artifacts and wardrobe stuff that can increase that move. Then it's got 18 wounds, a save 4+ and a bravery of 7. How does a bravery work on a vehicle?
Well, you don't treat it like a vehicle. I mean, you treat it like any other monster or anything. It's just a big metal monster. Am I interpreting that correctly?
You're correct. Yep.
Yep. So, I mean, you could consider the attrition, the wounds, the damage you're doing to the crew, because there's dudes all over this. And you know, Paul Murphy has a standing rule not to own models that require you to paint other models and glue them to
full
said models.
You've got to put more full models on this thing. This I don't mind, though, because it looks so cool. I saw a conversion where someone made it up to look like the Nautilus, like with a squid.
Yep.
Part of that thing looks amazing. I mean, this got all the potential just in this awesome model. So this got a ton of guns on it with, I guess that's the crew firing all the guns. But then it's got the damage table that we see. Now, for 40K players, this is going to be new, but for Sigmar, it's been that way. These large models with all these wounds, they have diminished capacity the more wounds that they take. And this could be their guns or weapons do less damage, or they move slower, or they have worse to hit rolls, or you know, anyway, they somehow weaken in their stats as they take damage.
That's the best thing and the worst thing about taking a unit that has that feature, the large units, if you will. As you take wounds, and you're going to take wounds, you know, you're depleting yourself. You know, you're less and less efficient as the time goes on. And so come late game, you're kind of not really worth much more than, you know, that little scrub guy down there. So, you know, you got to play it right. You have to have a lot of things to help regenerate wounds. If you have the ability to do that, that's very important, especially for these guys. But overall, with the transports and with all that in mind, with these guys specifically, it's underwhelming. You know, as a couple rounds go down and I pop a couple arrows into the side of the hull, I don't really fear it anymore. And that's how I've been, you know, engaging them. And, you know, a 4+ save is good. You're saving half of the stuff, but, you know, I'm modifying that, you know, one or two here and there.
Well, before we get too much into the specifics, let's dive down kind of deep into what this thing do. There is a way to make it a little bit more survivable, and that's got they have a rule here called bat down the hatches. In each of your hero phases, before any unit disembarks, the captain can give the order. If you do so until your next hero phase, you can reroll saves of 1 for the model, but no unit can disembark or embark.
Yeah, I mean, that's good. The nice thing about that is you can bat down the hatches, you know, drop off your guys and then start doing that, and then keep doing that, because anything that makes you more survivable is better, right?
I think so. Or, you know, you want to really push. I guess it depends on what the mission is. If there's a mission that you're trying to complete, maybe you need to boogie across the table and you just want to put everybody in there and drop them off late game. You know, I'm not sure what the tactics you'd use with this, but I think this built-in rule for survivability is fairly strong for what this thing is. Tell me where I'm wrong, though, guys.
The thing about the Arcanaut Ironclad, and I think the thing about the character on Overlords in general, is that these models require a lot of internal synergies to work. And the internal synergies in this book are a lot more complicated than any of the other War Scrolls or books that I've read to this point, because there's so much options. You have your six major skyports, and they all have unique benefits one way or another. And then you have the Kerridgen code, which allows you to basically customize your own sort of skyport system. So you can almost build the army the way that you want it, but without understanding how these models work together and without building things in tandem, that's where I think you're going to see things like the Ironclad. And the Ironclad so far is a big, heavy, you know, the big model in the Kerridgen Overlords. The Ironclad is 440 points, which is cheaper than a lot of the other super big expensive stuff, but it also feels a lot more fragile. That 4+ save seems, I mean, when I first saw that, I thought, wow, I mean, that's just a 4+ this on this big
tricks,
metal
though.
Thing.
This thing has
4+ is good. 4+ is really good.
This thing, now you guys, Miles and Kelly can tell me, and Justin too, with your experience playing the game, the things like the bomb racks and the supremacy mine. The supremacy mine is once per battle when an enemy unit that can fly ends its charge within 1 inch of the ironclad, you can launch the supremacy mine. When you do so, roll a die. On a 2 or more, that unit suffers D6 mortal wounds. I think this is like right out of that picture where he's got the bloodthirster getting set on fire as he's trying to charge this thing.
Yeah, that's brutal. Especially if you don't have the ability to save against mortal wounds. That is brutal. It's taking away some punching power.
And saving against mortal wounds is fairly rare, at least from all the arms that I've played.
What do you see that can save against mortal wounds? Like, what is it? What do they call that?
It's usually just an extra note on the model that says they can do it.
Yeah, so death has kind of like a, they call it a death roll, and it's pretty much on like a 6+. It ignores whatever wound goes through. It's kind of like a 6+, feel no pain. I know the Seraphim have something similar. I know
there's tons of relics and artifacts and stuff that give it out to you.
Yeah, so like the Iron Jaws have a necklace that only protects against mortal wounds. That's a relic that you can give a hero.
I guess when you need it, you need it.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, going back to this thing also being survivable, I think it's got that's a little bit of defense against things. And then it's got the Tireless Engine Rigger. This thing, on a roll a die for this model in each of your hero phases, on a 4 or more, it heals 1 wound.
Yeah. It's not as easy. Chris, you know, he's got this concept of it feels fragile. It's definitely not. It's going to take 2-3 rounds of really focusing it down to bring it down. Well, not really focusing it down, but if you're trying to bring it down and you don't want to, you know, dedicate too much to it, it's going to take 2 or 3 rounds because of these built-in reroll ones and regen wounds and stuff like that. And there's different characters too.
Yeah, I think this thing's a bit of a gunboat. Just, I mean, look, I'm just looking at the page. This thing's got a gun that shoots 10 shots to hit on 4+.
Yeah.
Yeah, with a red -1. I mean, that is not bad. Yeah.
That's just one of the guns. It's got tons of guns.
Yeah, right. That's just one of the guns.
It's a good start.
The Great Sky Cannon, which does D6 damage and a -2 to save, it wounds on a 2+. And the Sky is D3 wounds. I mean, this thing, I think, and torpedoes, and Aethershark carbines, and the Supremacy Mine we talked about, and bomb racks we talked about but didn't give the rules for. I mean, this thing, to me, I guess where I'm going with it, the model looks cool as crap, and it's got a full page of, like, tons of rules. I don't see how this can go wrong.
It's definitely good. I play a durable army, so what it's going to do is it's going to be able to thin out the things that it needs to thin out. The most that I've seen it played so far, and it's, you know, it's only been out, what, a week? 2 weeks at this point now?
Maybe a month. I don't know.
But yeah,
the book itself's probably been out in 3 weeks, getting on to a month. But I mean, what's really scary about this ship isn't necessarily the fact that it's covered in things that go boom. It's the fact that it can carry things inside of it that also go boom. And of those things, there's a couple of really, really sick combos that boost the effectiveness of the Ironclad. Like, for example, the Aether Chemist. Everybody's going gaga over the Aether Chemist. The Aether Chemist won't buff the Ironclad, but the Aether Chemist will buff the units inside. So essentially what this guy does is he has an ability where you can pick a unit within 10 inches of him, and you can add 1 to the attacks profile of any weapon that unit is carrying, whether it's a melee weapon or a shooting weapon. So if you have a unit of the professional shooting guys, the Grunstock Thunderers, they have a ton of super powerful weaponry. You were talking about the Great Sky Cannon, Paul. These guys have a handheld version potion. It's got a shorter range, but it hits just as hard. And if you can add one to the number of shots that cannon can make, all of a sudden you're dropping, you know, anywhere between 10 to 20 of these cannon shots at somebody. If you take the, I believe it's not Barrack Nar, but there's one of the barracks. It's one of the skyports that lets you add plus one to the hit roll if you take this relic and are within 3 inches. And that goes for the ship and for the units close by. So you get this chemist out, you surround him by a couple other units that get out of the ship. He's within 3 inches of all of them. They all hit on plus one, where they were hit, like, say most of the weapons are 4+ to hit. They're now 3+, and they're getting extra shots. Like, I don't imagine a lot of things really surviving that.
This is a very combo centric book. Everything about this book's all built on combos. To me, it reminds me of Warcon to an extent. Miles, you're familiar with them. That's your main 40K army right now. There's so much that you have to know to really build your army. It's extremely complex. It's a lot of bookkeeping and a lot of thought has to go into this. So to me, this is one of those armies that you're going to see a few people out there that just razor blade destroy through people. And then you're going to find a lot of players that are playing it because of the fun factor, and they might not be taking the right combos. You're going to see that kind of, filter through the tournament scene a lot more. And you're going to see, as a whole, people are going to kind of crap on the book a little bit, but it is a strong book. It might even be stronger than the Tzeentch book. It's just we need more time to digest it.
The best thing about this, in compared to my war convocation that Justin says, bookkeeping wise, it's all in one book though, which is a great thing. And Games Workshop starts you out with deployment and tactics in this book. Like, this book has so much more material inside of it that goes along with the army that I find it's a great book. It has to be the best book as far as that layout that they've put out for that. So I can see, like, there might be a learning curve with it, but I like how they give you, like, the basic tactics to roll with it at first.
That's pretty cool. And then we'll see, I'm sure, it expand as people start to adopt some of the battalions and stuff that boost up some of these other synergy things that we found. It's kind of, as to be successful in tournaments, what I found that is that synergy within your list goes a long way. And then you got to get lucky and be able to make charges, I guess, but definitely some of it sits down at list design.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think list design is going to be, Justin, you said earlier that the movement phase wins or loses games. I think more than any other army, the Caradhran overlords are going to have a next step of what synergies do you build into your list in order to pull this off. Because you could just roll a die for whatever Caradhran code bonus you get, and that's totally fine for the type of play that you would be participating in for that kind of a thing. But you will end up with some really non-synergistic armies that you will struggle to think, okay, well, these two units don't interact the way they're supposed to anymore, or in a way that makes it work.
Well, the way I'm looking at this, though, this is just going down and doing some analysis of what the numbers on the page are. Now, not taking a look at everything as a whole, but just kind of looking at this one thing, it looks like they've got a sweet spot with range. It looks like that 18-inch range is about their moneymaker for maximum killing power.
Now, they have one weapon, the Grunstock mortar, that's on the Thunderers, that has a 36-inch range and does D6 damage.
But that's not everyone. I'm talking about what the majority of the weapons are in this
book. Yeah, the majority, you're absolutely right. You're going to have to get into the danger zone.
Now, you got 24-inch range is another one, is like the next most common one, but 18 seems to be right there in that their maximum kill range or maximum threat range for most of their weapons.
And 18 inches in Sigmar is actually, for a lot of units, you're unchargeable. So
yeah, that's kind of a typical, like, long range shooting for quite a few armies, isn't it?
I'll take your word.
I mean, not super long range.
Okay.
Stuff I have that shoots is the longest is 18.
There is not a relic that lets you, like, get a plus one to your shooting. It is a command trait that lets you re-roll your shooting.
And so, Kelly, you see that more often, as 18 inches is kind of that the danger zone we were just talking about.
Yeah, 18 inches, at least in my experience, tends to be like where you really start to get hit with quite a bit of stuff.
Do you
There's there's the occasional longer range than that on a few units, but that's, at least from what I've seen, that's the majority of it will start at 18 inches and get a lot worse from there as it gets closer.
With knowing that, do you think that the mobility of a transport, of being able to get in something, move somewhere, to skirt that range or circumvent that in some way is powerful, or is it just kind of a neat gimmick that's in this book?
No, I think it could definitely be useful. This is another one of those armies where, you know, I've taken some kind of cerebral armies in tournaments that I probably shouldn't have taken over the last few years. And my goal for this year is to probably actually learn to play the army before I build the army that looks cool. So this is one that I'm thinking of playing maybe sometime around this time next year. And I think just with all the combinations and everything and things that you could do with the army, my plan this time is to really look at the book and look at the combinations and figure out what the best build for the army is before I go ahead and barrel into it and just throw it on the table.
Fair. Well, maybe we can help get you there with as we talk this stuff out.
That sounds like a good plan.
So is the frigate, the Argonaut frigate, and the Ironclad, is that the same kit and you get to choose what you build?
No, I think the Ironclad is bigger, correct?
Yeah, the Ironclad is the biggest one.
Yeah, the frigate's going to be a smaller one, so it's going to be a different kit.
Yeah.
So you can have a whole fleet of these things moving across the table.
Oh, yeah.
It gets expensive real fast, but you could.
But man, would it look cool.
It does. Mm. I mean, can you imagine the display board you can make just with all these flying ships?
I mean, you would have to pack it in another suitcase, Kelly. But
it's happening. It's happening next year. Get ready.
Like we said before in the other segment, that spray expandable foam. Make an awesome display board.
It will also, you know, keep it almost packed in there by itself. You have enough of it.
Right? I've been waiting for a reason to work LEDs actually into my army that makes sense and isn't forced, too. So I feel like thunderclouds are happening.
Oh, man. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it does. Stealing it.
So what are the bread and butter troops in this army?
Well, the Argonaut Company is pretty much the only core choice that we currently have. GW's teased that they're going to be doing some more with this army in some vague time in the future. But if you want to play match play with these guys, you're going to need at least 3 10-man squads of Argonaut Company.
Yeah, they're very, very limited right now with the range.
I understand that. Well, I mean, stuff looks great, though. I mean, like, keep them coming. The only one that I'm, like, not super jazzed on is I think we've moved past the phase where we need to include top hats in all things.
Oh, my God. Mode. I was waiting for the top hat comment. I'm against the top hat, too.
I think it's fully made up for with the mustache pistols, like the guns that come out of his mustache.
Yes. And speaking on that, I think this is the first army that GW has put out that there is no skin whatsoever on any of the models. It is all 100% metal. Metal beards, metal everything.
Is there skin on a Stormcast guy?
No, they have Stormcast with heads, with regular heads and everything.
The Heraldur guy, his mouth is actually skin as well.
I want to talk briefly about Stormcast since somebody else brought it up. I know a chocobo when I see it.
Yeah.
I want to ride my chocobo.
Oh, easy, Paul. Easy.
I'm
now, that's what the Sisters of Silence going to be riding is chocobos. Mark my words, metal chocobos.
I just want to get it out. I just want to make sure that I'm not the only one that saw it. I don't think I am.
Yeah,
I don't know.
No, they're cool. they're actually they're a pretty fun unit to use right now too. Their weapons are versatile. The choices you get to make, and they're super super quick, and they have these like dart moves that the Griff Rider.
By law, you got to pay 1 gold, 1 black, and 1 yellow in every unit. Okay, but back on topic with the overlords. Okay, talk to me about these. I think they're called the Sky Riggers with the balloon right on their back.
Yeah, there's the engine riggers, and the kit can be made into either those or the Sky Wardens. And the engine riggers, they're pretty cool because they're like a repair squad that also functions sort of like cavalry. They have a 12-inch move. They've got 2 wounds apiece. Very low model count in the units. The Sky Wardens are supposed to be more kind of like we are the paladins of steampunky dwarf dudes, but I think the engine riggers are where the money's at.
Why do you say that?
Well, they've got better shooting attack. They've got this auto pistol that can put out more shots than the Sky Wardens can. And they have pretty much all the same special weapon options, including the grapnel launcher, which I just love. It's basically like the hookshot from The Legend of Zelda, except dwarfs. So
does this move the whole squad when it happens?
The whole squad. So one dude, you shoot it at either a terrain feature or a unit with 10 or more wounds. And on a 4+, you can move up to 24 inches as long as you stay 3 inches away from that molly. You just and you're there.
They have 2 wounds apiece. These guys have move 12. We're talking about the engine riggers, right?
Yep. Engine riggers and Sky Wardens both have this particular war gear.
Move 12. two wounds with a 4+ save and a 7 bravery.
Bravery's a little low, but everything else is really good.
And it doesn't preclude them from charging after they do that. They can't shoot after they do that. They have to shoot all of their shooting attacks before they fire the grapnel launcher.
I know we're running short on time, and I do want to talk about one of these artifacts. And Chris, you actually found this when you were doing your initial pass. Can you run down that arc? Because I think it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, the Aethershock Earbuster. And this one, once you understand Battleshock, and once I came to understand it, that's where the money for this one came. And I'm just going to read you what it says. The Aether Chemist, Lux Zadum, discovered the unstable Shrieker isotope that caused the Aether Shots to wail. Pick one of the bearer's missile weapons to be fitted with an Aether Shock Earbuster. If any models are slain with this weapon, their unit must immediately take a Battleshock test. This is in addition to the test they must take in the Battleshock phase.
That sounds pretty powerful.
Essentially, what you do is you see like a big unit of something you want to get rid of. You shoot several units at her, shoot a couple dudes, pile on those casualties, and then shoot this guy at him last. Make them take that Battleshock test with all the losses that they took, and then they have to take another one at the end of the phase. You could pretty much seal the deal in killing a problematic unit with this weapon.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It's a good way to thin out some of those low bravery hordes.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is going to be a really good tool for them to. Because they are not a high model count army. Kerogen overlords they rely a lot on expensive units. Unit sizes are generally small. I mean, you look at something like zombies or whatever. Just so many more models. So this is going to be, I think, an important tool for them to just thin those big mobs out and force them to think twice about how close they want to get to this guy.
I also want to point out now that the there's vehicle war gear in this book.
Yeah. That's right. Every war scroll or every army that you compose, you can put a great engine work on one of the flyers and you can take a relic on one of your characters. And if you add a war scroll battalion, then you add one to each of those you can also take.
So any sky vessel can be given one of the following great injuries. And some of the stuff is, there's incredible self-healing hull. That sounds really convenient. And then we were talking about the magnificent omniscope.
Yeah, magnificent technicolor omniscope.
Apparatus makes the winds aetheric and apparent that to the ship's navigator, the sky vessel can move an extra D6 rather than D3 when it uses its aether navigation ability. That's what I was talking about before, giving extra movement to the ship. So in case you want to get somewhere and either utilize that embark or disembark rule.
It's definitely a good option for playing the objective game.
Yes, yeah, that's a thing inside of competitive play.
Absolutely.
Yeah, especially with how low the movement is for anybody that's not wearing a big metal balloon. I mean, you got a 4-inch move on your dudes. You're going to want some ships to carry them around. And the faster those ships can get from one point to another, the less likely you're going to get engaged, the more likely you're going to be able to nab that objective.
I think seeing these like 3 or 4 airships moving across and that being your army is going to look cool. It's going to lend itself to a lot of cool hobby potential, including displays. You know, we've already talked about 5 different ways to make this stuff look sexy on the show. And that's just casually. I mean, you really start to think about it, I think, and it's just no end hobby potential.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm definitely excited.
Yeah,
I'm doing something on a totally crazy tangent that you guys will see later, so we'll see how that goes.
Well, I can't wait to have my Iron Jaws bust some tanks open, or bust those flying ships open, and
gotta catch them.
Eat all the
yeah,
good
yeah, you
goodies
catch.
On this.
You don't get a supremacy mine popped off in that grill.
Yeah. Yeah. Close. It's just going to drop a big bomb in your face, right in that big Iron Jaw of yours.
That's okay.
And what I know? I'm just kindling for you guys. Where I'm at right now. God, speaking of kindling, just the sheer amount of Citadel woods that I've been explained to me that I need for my army. I feel I've been complaining about it for weeks.
You get on it.
Done. Have you got them yet?
No, I don't have them all. And then I'm, because we're actually, Miles and I are going to go try to play in England. And I'm like, how am I going to get on the plane with this stack of Citadel woods?
I'm pretty sure you could make some friends over there through the internet and let you borrow some.
I hope so. That'll be the other. That'll be plan B. If I can't figure out a way to get them all on the plane.
Nice. Those trees break easy too, so look out for that.
Oh, it's the last thing I want to hear.
Keep glue on hand.
Yeah, we'll see. I think you should make it. I've got a pretty good
suit. I always have glue on my hands.
Right. It's hard to fly with all of that. But we'll see. It's going to be cool. If we do make it over there and we do get to play on one of the Warhammer World tables for Sigmar with our Sigmar stuff in a castle. That will be very neat.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Lots of pictures to come. So check that on the Forge Narrative Facebook page. And I'll try to do a lot of streams to YouTube also.
Sweet.
But that's coming up in about a month and a week.
Yep, that's about it. That's about right.
We should have at least one more
Sigmar. Laugh it up, Fuzzball.
We should have at least one more Sigmar show done by then. I think we're trying to find our format and our rhythm here with these.
No, I'm excited because this is really a beginner's journey for me. I know I've talked with a lot of Thorata, but I look forward to putting these things into practice, getting my hobby game on with these skyships and laying waste in the mortal realms.
And I'm pumped.
It's so much fun, man. I mean, the complete difference of how the game feels and plays, it's refreshing, it's exciting, it's engaging, it's fun. There's never a moment where you don't feel like there's something you can't do. This is just, it's all in all, like, just perfect beer and pretzels, but it's got strategy, it's got competitiveness, it's got everything.
How long does a normal game last? Like a 2,000 point, 2,500 point game?
Hour and a half.
It depends on if you know your army. It depends on if you know your army.
For tournaments, I think usually they allow about an hour per game.
Wow. For 2,000 points? Uh-huh. Now we played 2.5.
Yeah.
Yeah, LVO, I'm pretty sure they had 2.5 hour rounds. They didn't all go to 2.5 hours, but that was the time they put aside for it.
Yeah. And when I say an hour and a half, man, I'm thinking middle of the road. You know, I've had games end in 30 minutes. I've had some games that last a little over 2 hours.
The point is, it's not 3 hours, and game still not be finished.
No. Right? If you don't get to turn six, it's because the game ended on turn three.
Yeah. There is no turn six in Age of Sigmar. So, huzzah.
The big difference is it's not five.
In the
books,
Age of Sigmar,
so.
Third and six is you.
Yeah. Now, you hit on a point. There's not a lot of books, Kelly. Is that what you're.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, you can play it on so many different levels, but it's the kind of game now where you could have, you know, you can play it and really think through the strategy and get really deep into the game at a tournament level. You can also, like, have friends over that have never played the game before and have them easily playing in half an hour.
What a world we live in. That's something we've been able to say about more and more of the Games Workshop games that we haven't been able to say in a decade.
Back.
Right. I used to play fantasy all the time, and my comment always was, because I could play it maybe like once a month or so. That's all I could fit in my schedule. And I'd always get to the end of it or get to the end of a 40k game and just be like, yeah, this game would be really fun if I had time to play it more often. Because inevitably you end up looking up rule sets and you end up, you know, comparing charts throughout the game. And it's like that holds up the actual play of the game quite a bit.
And there you go. It seems like they've solved it. And, you know, I'm all in. I said, I'm staring right now at a fully painted tree army that I want to roll dice with. And not only that, I painted my friend's Skaven army. So, like, I'm real deep into this. I'm vested.
Painted Skaven, huh? One color and dip it in a bucket. One color, dip it in a bucket. That would be great, man. That.
No, he's got a color scheme that's like almost similar to my AdMech. And so, well, he suggested
chipped metal rats.
He suggested a color scheme. I use the colors of my AdMech.
No, let me tell you what you really want.
That top layer of blue, it could easily be an AdMech cultist or whatever. A servitor, a rat servitor. Anyway, y'all, thanks for talking to me about this stuff. I know, again, folks listening to the Sigmar brand of Forge Narrative know that we have a lot of very different skill levels, and I think it's going to be important to kind of speak to each of those along the way and eventually get everyone to the same place, and that's what's going to be fun. And as we digest these new books, it's going to mean different things to different people on the show, and getting their take on it, I think, is going to help us all as we move along with this.
Yes, so grow with us.
Yeah. Anybody else got anything they want to add before we get out of here?
Ah, solid.
Yep.
Thanks, y'all, again. Good night.
Have a good one.
Good night.
Cheers.
I see dead people.